Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to a brand new Arseblog Arsecast right here on arseblog.com. How are you? Hope you're well. It's an interlull, which I'm sure you're very much aware of, and I apologize for reminding you of that fact, but it is a fact. There's nothing we can do about it. European teams are playing in the European Nations League thing, which I don't still understand, despite my best efforts at trying to figure it all out, but I've made absolutely no effort whatsoever to try and understand what the European Nations Cup is about. I know we spoke about this on the Arsecast Extra a couple of weeks ago when I was in Spain, and James tried to explain the format to me, but all I heard was, and to be brutally honest, I'm not that interested to try and figure it all out. You know, I think you can, as a human being, you can learn things, even if they're difficult, but I think it requires effort, just the tiniest, littlest bit of application of your mind. And I'm not prepared to do that with the European Nations Cup, whatever it is. It's the European Nations League. I know that much. So I will continue on in wonderful, blissful ignorance. I did see Jurgen Klopp say it was like the stupidest tournament that anybody's ever invented, ever. Clearly, he hasn't been paying attention to the new brand of reality TV shows, but I think maybe he was just talking about football. There is no Arsenal, of course, until not next weekend. If you had your hopes set on Arsenal coming back next Saturday or Sunday, your weekend would be once again infused with the very essence of Arsenal. I'm sorry, I've got bad news for you again, because we're not playing until Monday night, one of those Monday night games. I really don't like the Monday night games. So our interlull is longer than everybody else's interlull apart from Leicester. But then who cares about Leicester? Apart from, like, Gary Lineker, Alan Smith, he's a former Leicester man, so we can forgive him, his association with Leicester. But who else? Leicester fans, of course. But we're not here to worry about their trials or tribulations when we've got enough of our own going on. I've got enough going on here. I've got a completely destructive puppy. She's gone crazy this evening. I'm trying to record here. She's already torn all the stuffing out of her bed. And then her football, she's got football that she plays, but she's quite a good footballer, you know, German, so she's got some skills. The football that she's been carrying around with her for, I don't know, months now, she decided like she'd never seen it before and went absolutely berserk barking at it, like it was the first time she'd ever seen it. But then this happened the other day as well. I was taking her out for a walk, and all of a sudden she stopped dead in her tracks. All her hackles went up. There was a little bit of a low growl, and then the barking began. And if you've ever heard a German Shepherd bark, you will know that they're barky dogs. And what caused this barking? What terrifying, new, and unusual thing was she faced with that caused this reaction? A leaf. A leaf was blowing down the road towards her, and this was apparently the scariest thing of all time. It would be like me walking into my house to discover a gigantic owl dressed as a clown in my sitting room. That would be about the scariest thing I could think of. And that's what it was like with her. So there's something weird going on in her mind at the moment, and poor old Archer is standing around going, "Why? Why did you do this? Was I not a good boy? Was I not good enough for you?" And he's a very sensitive dog, Archer, so every time she does something wrong, he tries to get as far away from her as possible so he doesn't get any of the blame. And at the moment, he's getting far away from her quite often indeed. So while I'm up here recording, anything could be happening downstairs. I'm kind of afraid to go down, but the show must go on. And we do have Arsenal stuff for you on this Arsenal podcast. Surprise, surprise. In a couple of moments, we're going to talk stats. A little bit later on, Arsenal women and the challenges facing women's football in general and how successful we are, Arsenal are, as a club in the women's game. Tim Stillman will be along a bit later on to talk about that. But this week, there has been a lot of talk on Twitter about expected goals and Arsenal's ranking in terms of where we are in the expected goals table, in terms of how many goals we scored versus how many goals we're expected to score. So with me right now to discuss all that and to try and cut through some of the nonsense and waffle and perhaps overly daddy stuff that goes with all that. Delighted to welcome to the show Tim from 7am Kickoff, who many of you know used to do the By the Numbers piece on Arsblog News. He's still blogging at 7amkickoff.com. Tim, how are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm okay. I wanted to talk to you because I've been watching this week on Twitter interesting discussions. Sometimes they're not necessarily discussions. People seem to have some quite fixed ideas about certain things, particularly when it comes to stats. But we're talking, or I'm talking about expected goals, and Arsenal are ahead of where they're expected to be, to put it that way, in terms of the chances they've created based on the number of goals they score. But just for the uninitiated, I'm sure everybody's heard of expected goals at this point, but what is a really simple explanation for expected goals?
Shot percentage. So if you, in the olden days, we used to just, We took a look at all the stats of all the shots, and we said, hey, look, basically everybody scores at about a 10% rate. So then, you know, shots, 10% of all shots go in. So right. Then as we kind of looked in a little bit closer into the data, we noticed that shots from certain positions had higher percentages of scoring, and they started to put together these models, and that's what turned into expected goals. Expected goals is not simply just shot positions anymore. There's a lot of other data that goes into it, such as how many defenders are in between the shooter and the goal, how many, you know, whether it's a one-on-one with the goalkeeper, for example, whether it's a big chance, what the angle of the shot is, the distance from the goal to the shooter. So all of those factors now go into this formula, but in its essence, each shot is assigned a percentage chance based on all of the shots that came before from that particular spot with those particular conditions. So the example from the game against Fulham this weekend is Lacazette's second goal. The ball rolled across him. He didn't even take a touch. His first touch was to shoot it off the volley from about 20 something yards out, goes into the lower corner. Beautiful shot. Absolutely wonderful to watch goal, but it only had a 2% chance. It was only assigned a 0.02 expected goals, about a 2% chance.
Right.
And that's pretty normal. That's pretty normal for a shot from outside the box, is 2 to 3%.
Yeah. So what, for example, then would the, I'm curious, it just occurred to me before we move on, the Aaron Ramsey chance that capped off that amazing move with that amazing goal against Fulham. It was an incredible move from back to front, but does expected goals take into account the difficulty of the finish in a way like, you know, when they assign a higher score to a mark in diving, you know, high board diving or figure skating, that kind of thing? You know, Ramsey is quite close to the goal, but in order to make it go in, he has to pull off something a little bit special rather than just tap it into an empty net.
Precisely. That's exactly what it does. And so that particular shot had a 0.12. Now, I'm using a specific website for this data. This is not my expected goals number. And that number that I just quoted could vary from formula to formula because not everybody uses the same expected goals formula. But the one site that I use assigned that a 0.12, which is about a 12% chance. So, but you're exactly right in the theory that you're explaining, which is if I head the ball from 15 yards, my expected goals chance is going to be a lot lower than if I hit the ball with my dominant foot, you know, from the same position. Same thing with a back heel shot. I mean, the cross was absolutely perfect, but it was the right type of cross to help score a goal. but he still had to provide something extra special on top of that. So a lot of the frustration with expected goals is that they see or they hear me say something like, well, that was a 0.12, and they go, well, yeah, but he scored a goal. Mm-hmm. The other way to look at that is to say, yeah, but he scored a goal in a very unlikely position. So that's actually really fun to watch. It's cool. It's just telling you that he scored an unusual goal, just like Lacazette's goal from outside the 18-yard box. It just means that they scored unusual goals. It doesn't mean that they're, because the expected goals was low, that they're crap players or something like that. It just means that they scored an unusual goal. It's actually kind of showing us a cool data point there.
Yeah, I like the idea that there are various XG models. I don't want to go into the nuts and bolts of it, but I wonder, is it going to be like Betamax versus VHS? At some point, one will become the standard. But no, I think it is interesting, isn't it? Because it can make you appreciate a goal like Ramsey's, which you can appreciate, of course, on a very aesthetic level, because it's an amazing piece of football to watch from start to finish. But when you also look at it from the data side of things, that the difficulty of the chance to finish off what was that incredible move, you know, if you're that way inclined, that sounds wrong. But if perhaps you're, I think people are different in the way that they look at things. Like, you're clearly somebody who looks at numbers and statistics in a very different way than I do, because it's not really my thing, you know, maths and numbers and formulas and shit. I get it and I can appreciate it, but, you know, there are other people who just won't have any time for that at all. But, you know, if you can combine those things, it just adds to football, rather than this idea that somehow stats or expected goals are in some way damaging football.
Well, there is a tendency sometimes for stats people to try to bludgeon you with stats. And those people are annoying. And I have done that. And I have been that annoying guy. Sometimes with my column on Ars Blog News, I would be slightly annoying with some of my data. And yes, so that is, and in fact, there's a whole website called Stats Bomb, which is that's the phrase that people would use. Mm. They would sort of come in and carpet bomb you with stats and try to blow away your argument with stats. So that's a stats bomb. And yes, people do that, and it is annoying, and I have done it. But I would just say that, you know, most of the stats people nowadays are a lot more cautious about that kind of stuff. We're not trying to come in and destroy your argument by saying, oh yeah, well look, Arsenal are +9 expected goals, so therefore they're going to, you know, drop to 10th place. And, you know, most of us aren't doing that, because we're much more reasonable approach to these kinds of things and like to see the stats as something that enriches the game, as you're saying.
Yeah, I think it does. You know, I often cite the idea or the player ratings as something, for me anyway, that has been enhanced by the use of stats. And these are basic stats that we get from a game, the Opta stats, in terms of pass completion and tackles and defensive actions, attacking actions, all those kind of things. Because your eyes can tell you one thing, but your eyes can deceive you sometimes as well, where you think a player's had a terrible game, he's given the ball away a lot, and instead what he's done is he's given the ball away stupidly twice or three times, but the rest of his passing has been fine. But you're sort of prejudiced a bit by the terrible things that you've seen. So I think there's a real use for anybody who's serious about watching the game or talking about the game, writing about the game anyway, certainly to use stats, because they are so readily available now. So you talk about Arsenal having an expected goals of +9, right? So just to be very simplistic about this, based on the chances that Arsenal have created so far this season, all the shooting opportunities, they've all been given an XG, a percentage, what did you call it again? A percentage number? Right?
So
that adds up, and you are expected, based on that number, to score X amount of goals, whereas Arsenal have actually scored 9 more goals than expected goals. So is this a flaw in expected goals? Are Arsenal just overperforming? What happens here? What should we read into this?
Well, the first thing I would suggest is that we think of this not as overperforming, but rather or luck. That's a lot of people, you will mislabel this as luck. It's actually just variance. So you are always going to have teams that score more goals than are expected and score fewer goals than are expected. That is total normal variance, and especially in the beginning of a season. So what are we, 7 games in, 8 games in? Mm. And at the very beginning, it's like if you go up to a blackjack table and you throw down $10 and you win the first three hands, your variance is super high at that point. If you sit there at that table for 38 hands, you're going to have a much more even end of season take on the number of on the expected winnings from that. Same thing with football. The first 6 to 7 games of any season are always crazy variance. And you can see this in the position of the table position of the teams. So table position will vary wildly in the first 6 games because the points that they're gathering are you know, up and down. You lose 1 out of 6 games and it's a big deal. You lose 1 out of 38, it's not so big.
Yeah.
So that's what's happening. I would suggest right now, we've scored a couple of extra goals that maybe we wouldn't have scored in the last few years. And there can be some variance in those types of shots. And that's all that we're seeing. There's a lot of worry. And I think some people are probably stats bombing a lot of Arsenal fans right now with the idea that we're going to revert to the mean, or in other words, we're going to start to drop. We're not going to score as many goals as we are off the shots that we're scoring.
Right.
And that probably will happen. It doesn't necessarily have to happen. I've seen every season, every single season, even Leicester, even Manchester City last season, overperformed, quote unquote, overperformed expected goals by 15 goals. Chelsea overperformed expected goals the season prior by 20 goals. So, every season, and Leicester the season before that, you know, with their defense by 10 goals. Every season you have teams that, and in fact, the team that wins the league typically performs better than expected goals. The point of expected goals is to think of it as the average. So, of course, the best teams are going to overperform because that's what they do. You know, they are better than the average. That's how you win the league. You're better than average. So, hopefully Arsenal continue to overperform. Now, how much they're going to overperform, I don't know. But at this point, and the reason I say I don't know is because at this point we have way too much variance. It's just the sample size is too small. However you want to say it, it's just, there's just not been enough games to actually say, well, this is how Arsenal play football now.
I mean, it's possibly a positive sign that the attacking quality in the team, when you've got two £50 million strikers who are playing and scoring pretty regularly, that might be a factor in that. Whereas if you're playing, for example, Julio Baptista up front or a Marouane Chamakh up front, your ability to get above the average is much more difficult when you're playing with average players. But when you've got some really good players, above average players, might it not hold true that enhances your ability to score goals?
100%. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Lionel Messi always overperforms expected goals. End of story. Good players almost always overperform expected goals. So that's not always true. So somebody's going to quote me on that and then I'm going to get in trouble. But it is typically true that the good players overperform. Lacazette and Aubameyang are both overperforming, but only by a tiny amount. It's actually kind of funny to see the individual players. Currently, their expected goals, and again, this is off this one site that I use, understat.com. Their current expected goals are about 2.3 for Lacazette and 2.2 for Aubameyang, and they've scored 4 goals each. So there's a little bit of that. I mean, but you're only talking about 2 goals for each of those players. And again, you're looking at the first, you know, less than 10 games, it's completely normal to see numbers like that.
So when it comes to individuals within this Arsenal team this season, and you're somebody who takes a good look at this and a look at how players are performing, who's interesting from a statistical point of view? Because we can look at certain players and think, you know, they've come in and done very well, and we're enthused by their performances and their energy and everything else, but maybe perhaps somebody that's flying under the radar, or maybe some established players doing some things differently. What have you noticed?
The big numbers are for Danny Welbeck and Alex Iwobi, actually. So one thing I've been writing on my blog is that I really want to see these two players start. And the reason for that is because of a thing called expected goal chain. This is going to get a little wonky, but I'll try to keep it as simple as possible, which is how the player, how many touch, whether the player had a touch in an expected goal event. So, and in other words, did Iwobi, you know how you've seen this pass from Iwobi now four or five times in this, this season where he's charging at the defenders. He passes it off to somebody who made an overlap or an underlap. And then that person makes the cross that makes the shot.
Right. So it's their contribution, their contribution to a move, which results in a chance.
Correct.
Right.
And per 90, Danny Welbeck is the highest in our team. 1.45. So in other words, if he plays 90 minutes, Arsenal get about 1.45 expected goals. That's incredibly high. And Iwobi has the same, a similarly high number of one. And so, and I think we saw that. We've seen that every time that they've come on, they've really changed the game in terms of Arsenal's attack. And we saw them this weekend against Fulham. Now, again, this is a variance thing. You could see this as a very small sample size. But I would like to see those players play because they are having a positive impact on the underlying stats that we probably don't see very often. So, so I was really high on those two dudes prior to the Fulham match, which they proved to be really well. They played really well in that game.
They certainly did. I mean, I think, Welbeck and Iwobi are pushing, and maybe this is something I'm sure that Unai Emery is looking at. You know, if he is that kind of a manager who looks at every possible piece of information and data available to him, I'm sure he is absolutely looking at things like that and the contributions that the players are making. And, you know, it all ties up, doesn't it, into this competitive environment that he seems at this early stage of the season to be fostering within the squad, in the sense that there are very few players, you could look at very few players or established first team players who don't necessarily feel involved at this point. The only one I can think of is maybe Mohamed Elneny, who Emery doesn't seem to like that much or doesn't seem to fancy that much. He hasn't played him in the Premier League, I don't think, and I think he's only made three appearances perhaps this season in the cup games. So everyone else, though, is being given a chance in the first team and being given a chance to stake their claim. And when Welbeck and Iwobi play well, as they did against Karabag in the Europa League, he's bringing them back in and playing them in the Premier League away from home against Fulham just, you know, almost 48 hours later because of the late arrival back and the early kickoff on Sunday.
Yeah, that was a really incredibly bold move, I think, to bench. I don't know if bench is the correct word, but to play Mkhitaryan. And on all of these players, Mkhitaryan, Welbeck, and Iwobi all have very high expected goals chain per 90. So they're the highest three in the league or in the team. And so it wasn't a surprise to me to see them start on Sunday, except for that I thought it was kind of brave of Emery to do that, because the traditional people who would have high numbers in those categories are guys like Ozil. Mm-hmm. And he's not coddling Ozil anymore. So as you point out, he's just picking the guys based on numbers, and the numbers that they get are way more advanced than the stuff that I'm looking at.
Yes.
So they have an entire team that they're paying millions of pounds to produce very detailed analytics that we are not anywhere close to.
Yeah.
So if he has anything, he has more data than we do.
Right. Maybe I need to get him to write a column for the website. He's got access to all this, all this good stuff. Hey, he's on Twitter. You never know if he's still Twitter. I don't know how long that will last. He's enjoying the good times at the moment. What about the strikers? I think you noticed something about Aubameyang as well.
Yeah. So Lacazette. Well, one thing that's interesting about the expected goals number is I quoted a 2% for that goal that he scored. Over his career, he's actually a 9% from outside the box, which is very high. That's a Coutinho high.
Right.
So that means he should be taking more shots from outside the box. And I think that in general, Emery, I know that Arsene Wenger, one of the things I'm not ever going to speak badly about Arsene Wenger. Arsene Wenger overperformed with the teams that he had for a long time, finishing top four, you know, all those years. At the 8-2 year, when finishing top four in that season was some kind of a miracle. And getting that out of those players when everything went awry like that was he was a fantastic manager, and I'll always love Arsene Wenger. But one characteristic of his team was that he specifically told them not to shoot from outside the box. And the reason for that is statistics. Like, it's a 3% chance. It's a 2% chance. Do you want to waste that chance, or do you want to try to make a pass, an extra pass into the box and get a 10 or a 15 or a 20% chance? So Wenger was playing the odds. And if you have average players, playing the odds is probably the best way to do the best strategy.
Yeah.
Just like blackjack, you know, you're going to play the odds. So, but with Lacazette at almost 10% over his career, you might want to let him go ahead and have some shots from outside the box. And that's converting into higher than normal, you know, goals per expected goals for him.
Mm.
But one thing that's curious is that he also has Aubameyang shooting from outside the box. And Aubameyang has two goals from outside the 18-yard box this season for Arsenal, one in the Europa League and one in the Premier League. And when he played for Borussia Dortmund, he had three since 2013. So,
right.
So, and just the total number of shots, he's already eclipsed the number of shots this season that he had last season for Borussia Dortmund. So he is being told to fire from outside the box. We saw the goal that was just on the edge of the line for against Fulham, which was also a low percentage shot. But those kinds of things, I think he's being encouraged to shoot from outside the box. And I think it's great. I think it's exciting for the fans. And it beats expected goals, which is always fun to watch.
All right. Well, look, we will we'll keep an eye on this, and we'll catch up with you again a bit later in the season as the variance perhaps becomes more of the average, and we'll see where we are and whether we can keep this up. But, you know, people, if you don't read Tim's blog, please do. It's 7amkickoff.com. It's fantastic stuff. And we'll catch up again soon, Tim. Thanks a million.
Thanks a lot, Andrew. Talk to you later.
Tim is on Twitter at 7amkickoff. The blog is 7amkickoff.com. So if you're not reading it already, please do add it to your bookmarks. I assume that's what people still use, isn't it? I guess that's what people do. They just, you know, they open up Netscape and then they do Control D and it makes a bookmark. And then when you want to find a website again, it's like a handy way to find websites. That's what we do, right? Right.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/arsblog. Okay, it is a double dose of Tim on this week's Arscast. We have our Arsenal women correspondent from Arsblog News, Tim Stillman, with us to discuss Arsenal women, the history of the club, the success that they've had down the years, and some of the challenges faced by women's football in general. Hi, Tim.
Hello there.
I want to get a little bit of the history, or if you could give us a little bit of the history about the Arsenal women, founded as Arsenal Ladies back in 1987. Not one of the very first teams, but certainly one of the first big Premier League teams to set up a women's team and to really take it seriously.
Yeah, absolutely. It started life very humbly. So it actually was an arm of Arsenal in the community, where Vic Akers was working at the time. And Vic didn't necessarily completely set it up by himself, but I mean, he might as well have for the work that he put into it. He took it very, very seriously from the beginning. It was an arm of Arsenal in the community, a bit like, so Vic took over from a guy whose name I can't remember, but whose job it was to look after the celebrity and ex-professionals 11.
Right.
And so Vic took that over, and the women's team kind of almost came out almost as like, I mean, it was a community idea effectively. I don't want to say a novelty, because I think that's misrepresenting what Arsenal were actually doing. But it was we should do this. This is a good thing to do for the community. So for years, really, that's what it was. And obviously nobody was paid or anything like that. Nobody was paid to run it. Nobody was paid to play in it. It was just, I mean, it ran for the first few years, almost like the celebrity and ex-professionals team. They played when they could, and they kind of got into local leagues. Eventually, Vic came out of the Arsenal in the community department when George Graham was appointed, and George Graham wanted him as part of the football staff. So Vic said, and that's when he became kit man, effectively. So Vic said, yes, but I want to stay involved with the ladies team, and I still want to run it and manage it. So that's when effectively it came out of Arsenal in the community, and it kind of became a concern in its own right. But still, for many, many years, you know, right up until this century, really, nobody was paid or anything like that. Vic used to do really kind of inventive things. He'd get some of the players' work at the club. So I think Alex Scott posted on her Twitter really recently, when she first got into the team, a picture of her with Ian Wright, because she was working in the laundry with a couple of the other girls, and some of them had jobs in the box office.
Wow.
Some of them had like admin jobs at the training ground. Right up until 2014, Emma Byrne worked at London Colney in an administrative position before the professionalisation of the club. So he had all these kind of inventive ways of keeping them on the payroll through other means. In the early 90s, they had a bit of a rivalry with Doncaster Bells, who are older, more established, and who were the premium force in English women's football. But then in the kind of early to mid 90s, Arsenal really start to take over, and you really start to see the trophies roll in and the dominance start.
Yeah, I mean, they are, people might not realise it, but the most successful women's team in English football or in the UK. Mm-hmm. The amount of honours and championships and titles and trophies that they've won is quite incredible.
Yeah, it is. And it's funny, I always... So when people kind of ask me why they haven't won the league for 6 years, for example, and they should have by now, I think, I always kind of compare them to Manchester United, if you're looking for an analogous team in the men's game, in terms of they've got that history, that dominance. They haven't won the league for a few years when with their resources they probably should have. But they're still winning trophies. They've still won quite a few cups over the last few years. But at Arsenal, that doesn't really, it kind of keeps people just about happy, but not, you know, the players will tell you they're not hugely satisfied with the fact that, you know, they won the League Cup last year, the FA Cup like the year before that. Like, they're not, they think they should be doing better. The expectations and the bar is higher. And they're, you know, they're spending plenty of money. The wage bill is high. They're spending on resources and things like that. They're not the poor relations to Chelsea and Man City, even though Chelsea and Man City have clearly really started to pump money in the last couple of years. Arsenal are matching them, if not outspending them, in that regard. So that's why I kind of create that analogy with Manchester United, and this is also why, even though they haven't won the league for a couple of years, they can still go out and buy someone like they don't really buy the players, there's not many transfer fees, but they get someone like Vivian Medema from Bayern Munich, who has to be one of the top three strikers in the world, because and someone like Heather O'Reilly, because Arsenal is like a brand for women's players. It's a huge draw for them, and players still turn down Chelsea and Manchester City for Arsenal.
Yeah, I mean, some of the most famous women's players have either been at Arsenal or come through Arsenal or played for Arsenal at some point. You mentioned Heather O'Reilly. Obviously, she's American and a big star. What are the challenges for Arsenal, and not just for Arsenal, I suppose, any club like Man City, like Chelsea, that is taking women's football seriously and putting money into it and creating these teams and creating facilities and everything that goes on around a team? You know, there is marketing and there is match days and there's all these things. But the challenge of getting people, A, aware, or and B, interested, or maybe B in, or A, interested and B, aware. I'm not quite sure how it works in a way. It is a bit of a challenge, isn't it? Because there is a perception that, you know, it's women's football, and some people would say that to you as a sort of pejorative. So it is something that they, I guess, all clubs would have some difficulty with in a way.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of analogous to a non-league club, really, in that respect, in that what you're competing with now is ubiquitous Premier League and Champions League football. And the biggest barrier that they have, really, I honestly think it's the best value around. You know, Arsenal are playing Chelsea on Sunday. It's like £6 a ticket. And a ticket to a League Two game is over 25, is, you know, around 25 quid nowadays. And it's far, far, far better value than that. But the problem it's got is time. You know, top level football is so accessible and it's everywhere now that people, I think, for better or worse, just don't have the time to follow another team, another league. So I think if people watched it and followed it, I know this is a bit glib and a bit of a cliche, there'd be a, particularly, you know, you watch a game like Arsenal Chelsea on Sunday, the quality will be very, very high. And I think people would be surprised by it, particularly in the last few years. All the clubs in the WSL are professional now. They train all week. This is their job now. So, and Arsenal, that's been the case for the last kind of 3 or 4 years.
How much would you say the standard has improved since the move to professionalisation, not just at Arsenal, but in women's football in general?
So it has improved markedly. They've all got strength and conditioning coaches now. Arsenal didn't have a goalkeeper coach until 3-4 years ago. I mean, that tells you something, that Arsenal, you know, 4 years ago were training twice a week. They didn't have a goalkeeper's coach. They didn't have strength and conditioning coaches. The Arsenal assistant manager now used to be Joe Montemurro's video analyst. But he wants to put such an emphasis on video analysis that he's appointed this guy as his assistant manager, which again tells you it's quite a nascent stage in terms of analytics and things like that. And Opta have only just started doing stats. But yes, the level has gone up. The problem, I think, is now that the women's game, it's the kind of, about 5 years ago, it hit a real sweet spot where all of the teams were quite closely matched and everyone could beat everyone. And you had, I think in 2013, four teams could win the league on the final day. That doesn't happen now, because with professionalism, there's a much bigger emphasis on who's got the money. So you've seen clubs like Sunderland have fallen away, Notts County have fallen away, Donegal's have fallen away, because we're still at the stage now where most of the women's teams are funded by the men's teams, and Notts County and Sunderland and Doncaster Rovers don't have the budgets. Arsenal, Chelsea, Man City, they all still make a loss on their women's team. It's just, it's chump's change to them to make, to, you know, to lose £700,000.
Yeah.
Is nothing. It's a drop in the ocean. So there's still some work to do there. So what you've got now is quite an unequal league, again, where Arsenal, Chelsea and Man City are quite a long way ahead of everyone. And you might have seen, if you've been following the scores this season, you know, Arsenal beat Yeovil 7-0. They played Lewis, who are in the division below, and beat them 9-0. And that's kind of creeping back in a bit because you've got those teams with the big budgets separating themselves. And that's why it's starting to look a bit more like the men's game. And in recent years, teams like Bayern Munich, Barcelona, Juventus are winning the leagues in their countries. They never used to, but because they've got the big budgets with professionalisation, they can throw a lot more money at it. So the level has really gone up, but the level of competitiveness, I'd say, has gone down.
Right. That's a challenge as well, isn't it? When you're trying to get people interested in exciting games of football. I mean, it's great if you're an Arsenal fan and you see your team win 7-0. But if you're there for something a bit more than that or something a bit more competitive, that is going to be an issue for the game to sort out. I mean, do you see any way that they can sort that out? Or is it a case that perhaps more Premier League teams will launch women's teams? I mean, Manchester United famously did not have a women's team until this season, maybe. And they've set something up. So is it a case that that's going to be the way it'll go and some of these smaller clubs will inevitably not fall by the wayside, but end up playing at a lower level?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, we hit a bit of a tipping point about 3 or 4 years ago. So there used to be a rule when they set the WSL up that there was a wage cap of £20,000 a year and you were allowed to have 3 players over that wage cap. And that made for quite an equal league. And what it meant was, you know, Arsenal hemorrhaged loads of players as a result of that, because players who at Arsenal were like mid-tier players thought, oh, okay, I'm going to earn like 19 grand a year here. If I go to Notts County, I'll be one of the 3 best players and I'll get 25 or 30. So that was bad for Arsenal, but it was very good for the league. It created a lot of competitiveness. They removed this rule so that now it's like a percentage of turnover or something. And that's massively favoured like Arsenal, Man City, Chelsea, the clubs who really committed to throwing money at it. And that's really the route that the FA have gone down now. And it's a real shame because Donny Bells, for example, have gone down a couple of leagues. Sunderland, you know, pound for pound, Sunderland put, you know, more than probably any other men's team put into their women's team, relatively speaking. And Notts County, they really cared about it and they didn't necessarily have the money, but they went for it. But now, you know, and you've got Liverpool at the moment who are in a really weird position where they've not quite pulled the plug, but they've decided to spend less on it because they're looking at Arsenal, Man City and Chelsea and they're going, that's the kind of money we've got to spend probably just to finish fourth or fifth. And they're just thinking there's no point. This is an arms race. We can't win. So a lot of those clubs, Sunderland started to do it as well. They started to just think, well, we can't compete. So what's the point in throwing our money at it? So and Manchester United have come into this now. And in a couple of years, you'll see Manchester United come into this this group of teams with Arsenal, Chelsea and Man City, and it will look a bit like the Premier League, but they've decided to build slowly. But again, for them, spending a couple of million quid on their women's team it will make a big difference in the women's game. It will make no difference to them whatsoever. So that's very much, and you've got West Ham have come in, Southampton want to come in, and you know, I think the FA are looking at it in terms of promoting the game and looking at who's more likely to bring in the money, which the women's game needs, who's going to bring the eyeballs, which the women's game needs. So it is tempting and it is kind of true just to say the FA are chasing the money, but in the women's game there are actually quite good reasons to chase the money.
Yeah. So, I mean, if people listening to this are interested in finding out more about Arsenal women or attending games or, you know, getting involved with being an Arsenal women's supporter on an active basis, how do they go about that? Where do they play the games? Can you get a season ticket? Yeah. What way does it work?
Yes, you can. So I've actually written about this on Ask Blog News over the summer. So there is a beginner's guide to Arsenal women. But they play at Meadow Park, which is Boreham Woods ground. And the piece will give you kind of directions to there. It's about, so if you book online, it's £6 for adults and £3 for kids. But if you want to turn up and pay on the turnstile, which you can do for every single game without exception, that goes up to a tenner for adults and a fiver for kids. You can become a member as well, which gives you a season ticket, and it also gives you, for example, they do open training sessions. Sometimes they do members events, they do members prizes and things like that. And I think that's about, it's usually about 65 quid at the beginning of the season. But I think if you buy it halfway through, the price comes down. So you can be a member and a season ticket holder. And honestly, the crowd that they look for the most, that they aim things at the most, quite rightly, is young girls, because it's kind of about inspiring young girls to play.
Yeah.
And so if you've got, I'd say children, I don't have to be girls, but I'd say particularly if you've got daughters, it's a great place to bring them to. And absolutely without exception, the players go and spend time, particularly with the young supporters after the game. If you sit near the tunnel, like, absolutely without exception, it's a big, big part of what they do. They go and engage with the young supporters. They'll pose for every selfie, sign every autograph. They're very, very big on that. So I'd say if you've got kids, it's a cheap day out, good value, and you'll definitely get a smile from the kids if you bring them there.
Brilliant. Okay, well, check out Tim's stuff on Arsenal Women on Arseblog News. And, of course, there is a section on the official Arsenal website which covers the women's team, gives you the results, gives you the fixtures. So if you fancy going to a game, you can see what's on and when. So, look, thanks for that, Tim. I just want to talk to you very quickly before we go about Alex Iwobi. You've written a column about him this week for Arseblog, for your weekly column. One of the players, I think, who appears to be thriving, perhaps not quite the right word yet, because we're still so new into this season and new in the Unai Emery era, but he does look like somebody who is enjoying his football more this season than he did last season. I guess that's normal because the team was in such a weird state, particularly the away form and everything else. But he's not alone, but just the idea of Alex Iwobi coming good as an academy boy who's been at the club since 8 or 9 years of age. You know, he was a breath of fresh air. He was really exciting. He sort of plateaued, struggled a bit, but now appears to be back on the right track, and it's good to see.
Yeah, it's absolutely fantastic. And I think, and I say this in the column, I don't think he's a changed player. I think he's doing all the things that he's kind of always done. It's just what he does suits Emery's style of attacking a lot more, where Emery doesn't really play with wingers, but he plays with guys in the half spaces, you know, is the kind of word du jour, and that suits him. So that is his role. And I think when you were looking at him last season and he was playing in this like sludge of a midfield alongside like Wilshere and Xhaka and Ramsey and Ozil, and you think, you know, you put those players together and you think, well, what on earth is his role there? Because we know what Ramsey does. We know what Wilshere was in theory meant to do, but I don't think he could do it anymore. We know what Xhaka does. We know what Ozil does. I found it really easy to see last season. I would watch him and I'd think, I don't know what he's supposed to be doing. I don't know what his role is. Is he meant to be an 8? Is he meant to be a 10? Is he meant to be a left winger? Is he meant to be a right? Like, what? And is he meant to dribble the ball? Is he meant to pass it? Like, what's he meant to do? Whereas this year, I think it's just so much clearer for him. It's, yeah, you're kind of playing off that left side, but, you know, we don't want you right out there. We want you in that kind of half space. And the really good thing about that role for him is it doesn't demand the final ball. It doesn't demand a goal. It just demand. It's almost like the Thomas Rosicky kind of role, in terms of Rosicky wasn't a big goal scorer. He wasn't a big provider. It was just keep the game moving, keep the ball moving, keep your head up, move it around. And that suits him much more. And I'm thrilled for him because I loved him when he's the sort of player I really like, basically. I love a dribbler. and I think he comes across to me as a really nice, down to earth kind of guy as well. And look, it's always great when someone who's, you know, comes in at 8 years old, makes it in the team. And I found the juxtaposition last season really weird and quite interesting, how usually academy players get a bit of a break from the fans, but yeah. I don't think he did. And then there was Wilshere, who, was the kind of darling of the terraces. And I understand why, but who really wasn't performing, who really looked like he'd just unfortunately, sadly lost his game. And the kind of difference in treatment between the two, I couldn't always understand. But I'm absolutely delighted for him. And I think basically at all times, one of him or Mkhitaryan should be in the starting 11.
Right. Well, it's hard to argue considering the impact that he's had. And, you know, if you're looking to the future, you know, it'd be great to get Iwobi into the team more regularly. I think the one concern I might just have is that he doesn't tend to last 90 minutes very often. Is that maybe the next step for him?
Maybe, but I think that's an area he's really improved this season.
Well, I mean,
he's
bigger and stronger, isn't he? He's certainly physically much more robust and much. Yeah. I mean, I think one of his strengths, one of the things that people don't talk about as a positive in his game is his ability to back in to the attacker and shield the ball, hold it up, and then lay it off. I think that's a really important part of his game. And being bigger and stronger, more physically developed, I think is going to help him in that regard.
Yeah, hugely. One of the things he's always been really useful for is he can wriggle out of those tight spaces. I seem to remember Tayo being on this podcast about a year ago and
extolling the virtues of his
big African backside, I think was the phrase he used, which he does use to fantastic effect. And yeah, absolutely, I think his stamina levels look like they've gone up, whether that's a result of what Arsenal are doing fitness wise or whether it's just because he's 22 now and he's developing. It's probably a bit of both, to be honest, but yeah, definitely he looks like he's lost weight in the right places and gained muscle in the right places. If that makes sense, doesn't sound too homoerotic. Although maybe it should. but yeah, absolutely. Physically, I think that's another reason. So when I said I don't think he's a different style of player, maybe he's a different shape of player now.
Yeah. Well, look, hopefully that improvement and development continues throughout this season, because he's not the only one. There are others. We don't really have time to go into it, and we can maybe examine it in more detail a bit later in the season. But I do think there are others as well who are benefiting. While perhaps some of the spotlight is on the likes of Ozil and Ramsey, where do they fit? We can see other players who are taking steps forward. But one for another day. We'll leave it there. Tim, as ever, thanks a million.
My pleasure.
You know where to find Tim. He's on Twitter @Stilberto. Read his column every Thursday on Arsblog. And if you're interested in Arsenal women, check out the Arsenal women section on Arsblog News, which is, of course, at arsblog.news. Right, because it's the interlull, there's not a great deal else we can talk about, not a great deal more waffle. Just as ever, I want to thank you for listening to the podcast. I hope you enjoyed the show. I appreciate all the feedback we get by email, by tweet, by Facebook, and everything else. So thanks a million as ever. James and I will be here on either Monday or Sunday. I don't know yet. A lot of people have said they really dig the Sunday evening Arsecast Extra. It is a bit temporary, that's the only thing, because James has got a schedule that doesn't lend itself to Monday mornings at the moment, but it will probably revert to Monday mornings. But I don't know when we're recording this weekend. It could be Sunday evening. It may well be Monday morning. I will let you know. Keep an eye on the Twitter @Arsblog and @Gunnarblog, and we'll tell you when to get your questions in. So join us for that whenever it is. I'll catch you on the next one. Until then, cheers. Bye-bye.
Well, I tell you, this new Tottenham Stadium of ours that we're building is going to be absolutely world-class. World-class.
Right.
I've heard that the seats at this stadium are going to be closer to the pitch than any other stadium in the entire world of football. You're only ever going to be like 3.26678.0 meters away from the action, whereas at the Emirates, you're like 15 yards away.
Yeah, well, you know, that's good and all, but the thing is that the Emirates is, you know, open and built like. You can actually play football matches there.
But the new White Hart Lane is going to be all glass right above the stand, so the sound of all the Tottenham fans singing their hearts out will reverberate down to the pitch and absolutely terrify the opposition.
That's a nice theory and everything, but we got no proof of that, do we? Because it ain't built yet.
The grass on the pitch at the new White Hart Lane is going to be super organic, meaning that the ball will travel much more easily over the surface or slick pan-European passing will be spot on.
I have to say, I would be also very interested to see how you play your passing football on that pitch, you know, with all the tractors and cranes and coked-up contractors.
So I heard at premium level they're going to have 47 different kinds of Stilton. No other Premier League team has got more choice of cheese.
On the other hand, though, every other Premier League team has got the choice of playing their own games at, you know, home, because they've, like, got a stadium that works. Tell you what, though, I did hear, and I've got to give them credit for this, they've created a room specifically for people if they need somewhere that's, like, completely quiet, you know, sensory overload and all that. They can go here, and there's no way they'll be disturbed. It's going to be completely and utterly empty.
Ah, that is very interesting. What's it called?
Trophy room, mate.
Ha, bloody ha.
1961.
What?
Never mind, mate.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.